really been scapegoated for just about every blip in world food markets in recent years. Opponents of biofuels have attempted to tie ethanol and U.S. ethanol policy to every irregularity in the food market, every price spike, and really any emerging global threat to food security. Certainly, you remember that the ethanol industry was blamed for the high tortilla prices in Mexico and the riots that occurred there in 2008. You were blamed for rising malnutrition and starvation rates in Africa. You've been blamed for higher prices for Miller beer. You've been blamed for increasing the prices of gummy bears in Germany. And I'm not making that one up. You were also blamed in part for the food riots that occurred in Egypt this last year. Some of these wild stories aren't just reporters reporting the news. These stories, at least in our opinion, are being invented in the boardrooms of the Grocery Manufacturers Association, the Environmental Working Group, NPRA, and other organizations who wish we could return to a world of $2 corn and a world of no ethanol. So, at least in my opinion, if you take the time to peel back the onion, you see quite quickly that ethanol is at most a minor factor in determining consumer food prices. You see that biofuels and bioenergy in general are just bit players in the global food price equation. And I think you see also that biofuels offer enormous potential to spur economic development and improve livelihoods around the world. So, of course, not everyone sees it that way, and that really leads us to the purpose of our session here this morning. We at RFA have always believed there's value in having healthy and constructive debate on these issues and exposing our members to opposing views. That's why you heard from Scott Faber at EWG yesterday and API and others. And you're not going to like some of the things you hear today, I'm sure. But again, we think debate and discussion can lead to better understanding. So we've invited two accomplished experts to share their different views on the role of biofuels in determining food prices in the U.S. and abroad. Today we have Dr. Jerry Ostheimer from USDA and Dr. Steve Meyer, and they'll be debating the role of U.S. policy, U.S. biofuels policy, in determining U.S. and global retail level food prices and availability. Dr. Ostheimer is an American Association for the Advancement of Science and Technology Policy Fellow, working as an international affairs specialist for the USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. And importantly, Jerry has represented the U.S. at the Global Bioenergy Partnership discussions, and really that's where Jerry became involved in this discussion of food prices and kind of this notion of food versus fuel. Dr. Meyer is the founder and president of Paragon Economics, and he provides expert economic analysis on agricultural markets. He is the lead author of the CME Group's Daily Livestock Report, which I enjoy reading each morning, and I'm sure many of you do as well. Dr. Meyer is a former director of economics for the National Pork Producers Council and National Pork Board. And you can read more about both of these gentlemen in your program book. So we've kind of set this session up as a point counterpoint or debate, if you will. And so it's going to be fairly structured. We're going to give each speaker 10 minutes to make their opening remarks, and both have included a few slides to help illustrate some of their key points. And then they're each going to get 5 minutes to respond to what they heard from the other speaker. And then I'm going to pose some questions to both to finish up the session, and if some of you in the audience have questions as well, we'll try to get to those. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Jerry to get us started.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you all for joining us this morning. I know that there are planes to be caught and lunch to be had. So, first of all, let me again echo the very always rousing comments of my boss. Secretary Vilsack is a tremendous advocate, and we are very lucky to have him as our secretary, and I want to echo his comments. Thanking you for your efforts that are really showing tremendous benefit for rural America, and thank you for that. So, as you all know, the stage for essentially our presence here actually was largely set by the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007, which created the Renewable Fuel Standard, which we all refer to as RFS. And I'm not going to walk you through the mandates, but really I would just like to point out that the RFS 2 had the following effects, which is that it mandated domestic use of conventional ethanol to be phased in from 2007 to 2015. And in the end, when we get to 2015, that there will be mandated domestic use of conventional ethanol will actually be capped at 15 billion gallons. And I'd just like to sort of pose this rhetorically as, Secretary Vilsack talked about our values. And I and the Foreign Agricultural Service continuously try to reflect U.S. values as being a good global citizen. And because the U.S. government is so concerned about global welfare, not just our welfare, but global welfare, we limited the use of our phenomenal biomass resources. So we capped our own domestic consumption of fuel from our own production. So this was, we don't tend to give Congress much credit these days, but this was very forward thinking. So we were open to the possibility that our policies would have an impact, and so we set this cap. And just as importantly, we phased in this effort. So we understood that increasing this demand would have an effect on global markets, would have an effect on price. And so we chose to do so not in a shocking way, but in a steady, clear, and transparent way. And the result has been phenomenal. So these stable policies have encouraged planning and investment that have met our goals for energy security and have promoted tremendous economic growth. And I can actually report to you from my work at the Global Bioenergy Partnership that the rest of the world is looking at the United States. The developing world is looking at Brazil. The developing world is looking at Argentina. And what do those three countries have in common? Well, they've done three things. So the rest of the world, agricultural productivity has stagnated. Growth of agricultural yields and productivity in Africa has gone nowhere. There's been no investment there. But where has there been investment? There's actually been investment in countries that have forward-looking bioenergy policies, policies that really push the envelope, really encourage the innovation in the energy sector. And I think that there's a lot of feedback between the energy sector and economic growth from agriculture. So moving on, RFS2 created this demand, and American producers have responded. And so what we're looking at here is a plot broken into different sections of millions of bushels used in the U.S., and then on the x-axis is the time. And what we see is that there's been a huge increase in the production of corn. So the RFS2 created a signal, a market signal, a clear signal, an unambiguous signal, and farmers and producers responded, and responded rather remarkably. And what's impressive is that essentially our exports of grains, our export of corn is unchanged, and so essentially the whole change that's going for alcohol has been captured by this increase in production. So basically, corn supplies for feed and exports are comparable to pre-ESA levels. In addition, our net production of feed has gone up because, as you all know, dried distiller grains and solubles is an output, is a co-product of the ethanol process, which can go directly into the feed market. Okay, so we seem to have met this demand with supply, and yet corn prices have gone up. So despite the supply response, corn prices have increased. And if you look at inflation-adjusted corn prices, actually the price spikes that we're seeing are not that unusual by historical standards. And if we make our gaze even broader, we see that all agricultural commodities have sort of paralleled each other and have undergone similar spikes, which seems to be indicating that there are broader factors at work. And so then if we actually just kind of look, compare food to all commodities and crude oil, we see that they track very, very closely. And so this furthers the impression, actually, that there are broader factors than just the RFS2, because if you just look at the production, it seems that farmers knew RFS2 was coming, and so they responded. And so my second to last slide, which is that there are essentially 8 factors that will contribute to commodity prices over the next decade. And something, a major driver, and this has been mentioned before in this this conference, is the fact that we're going to have more people, but we're going to have wealthier people. And wealthier people eat more and better food. China will buy every last soybean. I think China is sweeping the soybeans out of our rail cars because they're growing and they want to eat more meat, and so their demand is really quite insatiable. And they're not alone. There are other countries that will likewise continue to increase the global demand for these commodities. Second is that agricultural input costs, including energy prices, have continued to rise. And this really matters, particularly for American food prices, as Secretary Vilsack pointed out, because the Americans don't buy commodities. Americans buy food. And then food is the result of processing, transportation, marketing, packaging. And as he pointed out, a lot of those use a lot of petroleum. And so actually what we should be thinking about is creating the feedback where renewable fuels actually can reduce the cost of food by reducing the cost of energy necessary to do all of these other things. And as the Secretary pointed out, the renewable fuel sector has laid the base, the infrastructure base, and really the intellectual base for the next phase of the growth of the bioeconomy, which the Obama administration is really pushing, which is bio-based products. So instead of petroleum-based packaging, we could have a cornstarch-based packaging, for example. And what's really happening is that ethanol has really pushed and brought to the national attention the potential for profit in this region. Something that's often not discussed in the media is the fact that a major, major contribution to commodity prices is actually the value of the U.S. dollar. So even though corn is traded on the Chicago Exchange is actually representing a globally determined price. And the fact that the U.S. dollar is falling means that it takes more of our own dollars to buy our own corn because the corn is actually being set outside. And so this falling dollar, while it's actually good for exports, it actually makes our own commodity more expensive. And so that actually is a major contributor. And then at FAS, things that we're trying to fight against or things that we're trying to fight for. First, we're trying to fight for trade liberalization. We're trying to fight against policy errors. So it's very clear that 2007-08, that food price spike was way larger than it had to be, and it was greatly exacerbated because other countries that should have allowed the markets to adjust, other countries that take a more prescriptive approach towards policy, they put on export bans. So Russia banned the export of its own wheat. So of course the markets are going to respond. We're seeing oil prices go up. Do we have less oil? No. It's because the markets are overreacting to a perceived threat to the flows. Anyway, sorry. To wrap up, the U.S. is also working to promote sustainable bioenergy production and use around the world. And I'll be more than happy to talk about that at length because that is the mission of the Global Bioenergy Partnership. The U.S. is also promoting, and this was pointed out in one of the earlier talks, on the importance of technology and the need for improved agricultural yields. And we in the U.S. government feel that in the developing world that we can create synergy between improved energy access from bioenergy, which will improve agricultural yields, which will lift all boats for all people. And then lastly, as was also talked about in the earlier sections, because of the global demand, there will be increases in production that will also come from additional cropland. So I'm a little bit over time. Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here today. I'm going to agree with Jerry on several points, and I'm going to disagree with him on some. In an early email on this, Jeff said he was looking for an anti-ethanol economist. I'm not an anti-ethanol economist. I want to point out that, if I can get my clicker to work here. Let's take that one. I'm not opposed to ethanol. I prefer it aged in oaken barrels or served in pretty glass bottles. And I'm not even opposed to fuel ethanol. Expensive oil and gasoline clearly have provided an opportunity for ethanol and are a reason that we should continue to make biofuels. There are important national security questions here. Your industry has helped us address those and will continue to help us address those. We would have eventually been here regardless. At today's level of output of ethanol and beyond, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind in that. My problem with ethanol is not ethanol, it's the policies that we've had to get here and the impact they have had. And the biggest thing was that our U.S. ethanol policy did not match the rates of change that we could have in output of grains and especially of corn over time. And I'm going to show some data that will contradict some of what Jerry said, so I think we got data from different places maybe. But still, the supply of total feed grains and high-energy feed ingredients for the U.S. livestock and poultry and dairy sectors has gone down. Ethanol policy never recognized or compensated the losers it created. And most times we have policies that create winners and losers. The losers get compensated. The renewable fuel sector, in my opinion, has not owned up to the impact that the negative part of it. Now, that doesn't mean you haven't had positives, but there have been negatives. As Milton Friedman said, there's no such thing as a free lunch. I'm going to skip this one and this one because Jerry talked about the renewable fuel standard and the rate of increase and go to this slide. This is uses and not a stack diagram like Jerry had, but one of individual uses of corn. I think it's almost impossible to look at that and say that ethanol didn't have an impact on the price of corn. While total production went up, the portion of the ethanol of the corn crop available to other uses has steadily gone down. And if we look at world stocks, corn ending stocks, stocks are about where they've been in the years past, but the stocks-to-use ratio on the world level is low, a record low actually this year. And why is that? Because corn usage has gone up dramatically, even relative to production. If we look at soybean stocks, on the other hand, very high, and yet we have record high soybean prices. If we look at wheat stocks and stocks to use, they've recovered tremendously the last few years with better crops. But still, in a historic basis, they're quite high, and we have record wheat prices, or close to record. I would argue that there's not something else going on that causes these things to move together. These are generally substitute goods, or they compete for the same resources in the case of corn and soybeans. And so the price of one going up drags the others up at the same time and contributes to higher costs of commodities across the world. If we take the amount of feed usage of the five major feed grain crops in the United States, corn, barley, sorghum, oats, and a proportion of the wheat we produce, and we add those up and we put those on a chart, this is what it looks like. It's declined for seven of the past 8 years. Now, I completely recognize that we get feed ingredients out of the ethanol refining process, and DDGs have filled that gap, but the trend is still downward. And this is at a time when we have increased our production. And in a world that needs more U.S. livestock, meat, and poultry production in the future, and yet we're going to have fewer feed ingredients to use, it looks to me like, for the foreseeable future, at least until the renewable fuel standard runs its course and caps out at 15 billion gallons in 2015. DDGS, like I say, it fills the gap, but it's hardly an equal feed ingredient. It's very good for cattle, it's not very good for pigs, and it's even worse for chickens. And now that most of your plants, or many of your plants, are starting to spin the corn oil out of that product, it gets even worse for the monogastrics side of the business. It's not going to have much value there. There have been losers because of ethanol. Now, you'll look at this chart and say that cattle feeders didn't know how to make a profit to start with, and that's greatly true. But they never saw the kind of losses that they saw between 2008 and 2010 in the history of the business. If we look at hog producers, We had a tough year in 98 and 99, but nothing like we had in 2008 and 9 when $6 billion of equity left the business as feed prices rose. And by the way, that happened on prices that were very close to record high for hogs. Okay, so it wasn't a fact of cheap hogs or overproduction. It was mainly the fact that we had high feed prices. If we look at the poultry business, their first row of high feed prices was tempered a bit because one of their major companies, Pilgrim's, took some terrible bets on grain prices and had to start shutting units and kind of moderated the losses for the industry there in 2008. The second round of high feed prices met with some expansion by that industry, and so we can say that some of that's their fault for sure, but huge losses recently that has resulted in the bankruptcy of four poultry companies this last year. So, you know, I think this is a perfect example also of David Ricardo's theory of economic rents. And in the case of this, rents are not what you pay to live in a building for a while. It's supernormal profits over and above the normal rates of return that are necessary to keep capital invested in a given application. You know, all rents eventually accrue to the holder of scarce resources. In some cases, that's a patent or a copyright. In some case, it might be a unique talent. You know, Celine Dion can sing pretty well, and she has captured significant economic rents because she can sing better than most others, and she looks better than most others, too. Land, though, is the real scarce resource in agriculture, and we've seen the same thing happen here. This is Iowa average land prices from 1980 through 2011. And these higher values for ethanol, then for corn, and now for land are being capitalized back into that land price. Part of this, of course, is extremely low interest rates. And we need to recognize that fact. But the big part is that we're having cash revenues generated on those lands that are much higher. If we look at the consumer price index for a number of food items, this gets a little busy, but I would focus your attention on two lines here. One of them is the line, the red line for food, which went up in 2008 and 9, and some people blame that on ethanol. I think it was very, very short-sighted to blame that on ethanol because it was mainly an energy-driven situation. And the only part of that food price index that went up were those that were directly derived from grains, breads, cereals, those kinds of things. And we know that the grain price has a pretty minor impact on those because of processing and transportation and retailing. But look at the green and the purple line. The purple line is the bottom one with the crosshatches in it. They're just now starting up. Green is meats. Purple is poultry. And we're going to see those go to record levels. Average beef prices this year are going to be close to $6 a pound on all choice beef. On choice beef. Pork prices are going to probably exceed $4 a pound on average. Chicken prices jumped 5% last month and will rise even higher because of the production reductions they've had. And so those prices take a long time. Here's that graph. I guess I should have gone to it. A long time to filter through because it's a biological process. Losses occur. Reductions happen. It takes a year to realize that from pigs. It takes 3 years to realize that from cattle. It just takes a long time. And so the real impacts on food prices from ethanol, in my opinion, are just now being shown. One thing I want to point out is there's some distributional effects here, too. Do $6 average beef prices really impact anyone in this room? I would argue that they haven't really affected how much beef the Meyer household consumes, and neither has $4 pork prices. But that's not the case for all of our citizens. There are people that this has a negative impact on without a doubt, and it's even worse if we look worldwide. Worldwide food prices up 70, almost 80% since 2006, according to the FAO. And those are larger, obviously, than they are here because there are some people that are much more grain-based than we are. Last year, food prices worldwide, as estimated by FAO, went up 23% just in 1 year. So it's kind of hard to argue that something isn't going on driving these. Now, I show you this picture with some trepidation, and I want to make sure that all of you realize I do not blame this picture one bit on ethanol. In fact, this picture was taken in 1996. It won a Pulitzer Prize. It was in the throes of the first Somali and Ethiopian drought and famine. But it is a picture that it's heart-wrenching to me. In fact, if you had been in Washington, D.C. at the museum last summer, you would have seen a large gray-haired man standing behind a petition weeping because I had seen this picture. Now, is more food the answer here? Yeah, it would be. That'd be a help. But the real thing is we have to have economic development there. These people have to have a way to grow food and earn a living and have a way to have a voice in a stable government. And all those things have to work together. We can't have one without the other. And we need to be very honest and open about the impacts of the things we do every day. In closing, my request to you would be proud of what you have done to reduce the dependency on unfriendly oil. You've helped our national security. You will continue to do that, and I appreciate it. Allow markets to decide the future. Now, I'd ask you right now, given that we exported 1 billion gallons of ethanol last year, just what are we going to do with 600 million more gallons each of the next 4 years? That's going to be a little bit of a problem, I think. Recognize that there is indeed no such thing as a free lunch and that benefits of ethanol are not without cost. And finally, support flexibility to allow man's highest needs to be met. I think we need to let markets work. I think we need to be flexible in what we do. And I think we obviously need to treat each other with respect and caring, even if we disagree. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, for that. I think that there's very broad agreement on the data. I think that there might be some disagreements, which for the sake of pedagogy, I will emphasize. First of all, you sort of asked this question of, well, what are we going to do with this additional ethanol? Well, there's a tremendous amount of unmet demand for renewable fuels in the world. So we saw Rob Verhoot talk about, I think even in his own talk, when he was letting us know that he's going to try to block our imports, I think in his own talk he pointed out that the EU Renewable Energy Directive is not meeting its own targets. And the U.S. Is a fantastic place to actually to meet that. And in so doing, we will contribute to the global supply of fuels, which will have the beneficial impact of reducing global dependence on foreign oil, which will have the impact of raising all boats. Another point that you alluded to was Well, and then also wanted to point out, so Brazil is also not meeting its mandates. And so there's a lot of unmet demand. And then, as I said, developing countries around the world, they see the potential for bioenergy to create the same sort of rural growth, the same sort of economic growth that rural America is experiencing right now. Second of all, you sort of alluded to this concept of flexibility. And we at FAS, we deal with this issue of food security every day. And there's a lot of different viewpoints on how best to achieve food security so as to shoo the vulture. And the way that we want to do that, actually, is through transparent markets, through transparent, well-functioning government, and through increasing global production of commodities. And so the RFS2, as I said earlier, provides a very transparent, how it's implemented, even by EPA when they do their greenhouse gas calculations, it's done in a very transparent way. And again, I think that this was done so as not to perturb markets. And we would encourage other countries to run their own governments and their own food prices likewise in a transparent way. And so I'm not sure which country the vulture picture came from, but the fact of the matter is that in every country in West Africa or every country in Africa has a different policy towards food. There's tremendous amount of subsidies for food, and the trade is very opaque and very indirect. And so actually, rural smallholders in Africa are not sensing global commodity prices. And because if they were, they would be profiting and making money and having an increased household welfare. So they're not sensing it because the policies of those countries tend to favor the urban poor. And so there's price support mechanisms that prevent market forces from cycling through. And so that's sort of just a broader issue in terms of food security. I think, Steve, you and I, we both share the goal of responsibly feeding the world. And again, I would make the point that the way to achieve that is by steady policies, such as we've had in this country, that will continue to promote the investment in agriculture. So as I said earlier, Africa has lagged in its agricultural development because there's been very little investment. And I personally am working on projects in West Africa where we're trying to use bioenergy as a catalyst to recruit investment into the agricultural sector that will result in the production of more food. And so we are partnering with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization because they did something very intellectually honest. They went to the developing world and they asked the question, what is the impact on food security from local bioenergy production and use? So not the global commodities, but the local. And they came back with the answers that it depends. So there are ways that you can actually produce food so that you end up, you produce energy and bioenergy that end up increasing food security. So you hear a lot of conversation about, oh, we're going to use non-food crops. Actually, if you go to rural Africa, that doesn't make any sense. You want to use food crops for energy. Why? Because you're making more food. And so if you actually encounter a situation where you end up having a low yield, you can always eat the more food that you're producing, for example, cassava. And so to wrap up, I would say that we agree on a lot of things, but I think that the solution is not backing away from our clear, transparent market signals, but instead emphasizing that transparency and engaging the world and encouraging them to, in a sense, recreate the success of what we have in this country.
We may have to agree to disagree on this one, on one point here. I guess the point I would have is I agree that we are all better off with transparency. I don't think there's any question about that. We know what the rules of the game are. They shouldn't be changed willy-nilly. They should be steady. My concern on this one is that transparent is not always good. It doesn't mean that the policy is right. And I would still propose to you that a slower increase in the renewable fuel standard would be better for us. Let me point out right now that over the next 4 years, if assuming away the RINs that are there, and I know there are RINs that will be used for part of this, Jeff, 600 million more gallons of corn-based ethanol per year each year would be 218 million bushels. Until if we take that each year through 2015, that's 990 million bushels more corn, okay? That means that we have to increase yields, I think, 10 bushels per acre, just about, to get that done, all right? I think that's a pretty aggressive kind of goal. I don't argue with the policy. I think the rate of change that has been posed has been too fast, and it's caused less feed grains to be available to the livestock and poultry business. And I admit I'm biased. I mean, that's where I work. I think it's driven up the prices of feed to lots of people, food and feed to lots of people in the world, and it's caused some of these. Long term, Jerry, I'm right with you, okay? I think we have to do those kind of things and grow together. But rate of change is important. It's so important in economic matters, and you can't get the cart before the horse on these things.
Okay. Okay, well, I'd like to thank both Jerry and Steve for some very interesting back and forth, and I think it's pretty clear that we have some folks up here on the panel that feel strongly about their positions. What I'd like to do at this point is offer up a few questions myself to both Jerry and Steve, and then we'll open it up to some questions from the audience. But I guess the first question I have, I'd direct at Steve first, and that's around the issue of co-products. You showed the one chart there where you added on the effect of distillers' grains to net feed availability. And, you know, I felt like maybe you were giving short shrift to the value of co-products in the livestock and poultry diet. You know, USDA very recently said across all species, a pound of distillers' grains displaces more than a pound of conventional feed, and I doubt that that was factored into that bar chart. But I also think there would be lots of folks in the swine industry that would disagree that distillers' grains is not a good feed product. I mean, we know that kind of the common inclusion rate today in the pork industry is 30% of the diet. So I'm just wondering if you can speak more about how the pork industry specifically has improved its education of how to use these co-products, how to maximize the use of these co-products, how to benefit from the high protein content, and kind of where you see distillers' grains fitting in to, you know, specifically pork and poultry diets moving forward.
Well, distillers' grains, don't get me wrong, they're useful, okay? But when you compare the usefulness of distillers' grains between monogastrics and ruminants, it falls definitely in the camp of the ruminants. And the reason is that while there is a high protein level in distillers' grains, it's low-quality protein. It's not the right amount of amino acids or the mix of amino acids that are needed by monogastrics. The ruminant can make that protein into high-quality protein through the microbes in the rumen. They can also digest the fiber that's in there, which really is not available to most monogastrics, very, very little of that energy. And so there's no question that it's better for cattle. Doesn't mean it can't be used for hogs, and we've used it. You're right. I think there are a lot of producers that have 20 to 30% on average in their diets, maybe 30% up to the last couple of weeks, and then we tend to pull that out because of some possible problems with corn oil and what it does to fat content. So it's not that it isn't a good feed source, but, I mean, the point is we put 56 pounds of corn in and we get 17 back, or 15 and a half or 16. I don't know exactly what that yield is. And so from a volume standpoint, it's not a good trade for the traditional users of corn, obviously. And we've learned how to use it, and it's very, at times, most of the time now, it is cost competitive. In the early years, the cattle business bid it away from us every winter. And they did it again last November because they've got so many cows on very poor grass and very poor hay at the present time. So it's used. It's, you know, if you talk to the people that use it, you know, one of the things they do, it's lower energy. And we have pigs that grow a little slower on it, but that's the economics. And we will adjust to that and use it economically where it can be used. And we have.
Jerry, any comment on the co-products?
No, I think you captured it pretty well.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, I guess I would direct this question at you then, Jerry, and also would be interested in Steve's response. You know, I think Steve very clearly, you know, showed several charts that showed the increasing, you know, the rise in basic commodity prices over the last several years, corn, wheat, and soybeans specifically. And certainly, you know, there's nobody in this room that's going to argue that prices for those commodities haven't risen substantially. But what I didn't necessarily hear from Steve's presentation is how much of that increase do you believe is actually due to the ethanol policy itself versus other factors? And I'm sure you're familiar with some of the recent work that Bruce Babcock has done at Iowa State that kind of attempts to, you know, parse out what was really driving corn price during this period of ethanol expansion, and he found that it wasn't the RFS. It was $100 oil, and that ethanol was going to get produced one way or the other, which, you know, you alluded to. But I guess, you know, if I could boil this question down to a fine point, how much of the increase in corn prices over the last 5 years do you attribute to ethanol policy specifically?
Again, I kind of feel like you've answered the question. But I'd like to make one point, which is that, you know, there's my background actually involves a fair bit of computation and modeling. And there's a phrase that I think is really useful, which is that all models are wrong, but some models are useful. And so I really don't actually put much weight on what number comes out of what model, because invariably the way it's sort of seized and sort of thrown about is people grab the number, but then they forget the error bars. And so I'm not really, I want to resist that answering that question directly. But I do think, you know, I put up my, my office has this 8 factors contributing to the global price of food. And we do feel that our analysis is quite strong on that. And so we do feel that the commodity price, the RFS2, the commodity price contribution is quite small. And maybe a piece of data as opposed to a modeling result, but a piece of data that will put this into perspective is that globally, this is from FAO, 67% of land is used to directly grow food. 3% of land now is used to grow energy. And the rest, 30%, is used to grow feed. And so I think that the contribution of bioenergy probably is pretty close to those percentages, you know, probably short by a factor of 2 or 3. So I mean, the main, something that we forget is globally the main effort is actually on, is still overwhelmingly on land that goes to food production and feed production.
Steve?
Jeff, I would agree that the renewable fuel standard is one of many factors. I mean, we have a rapidly growing world economy. We have people in countries that whose incomes are growing, and they're buying more animal-based proteins, which use more feed grains, and I understand that. You know, I would defer to Professor Babcock and others in their estimate. The point I guess I would make is that the link between energy prices and corn and grain prices is really the ethanol business, in my opinion. And it grew very, very rapidly. And because of that, we, in my opinion, again, we haven't been able to keep up on the supply side. Now, will we be able to do that in the future? I think we will. And Professor Silberman said a while ago, you know, if we had better policies, or in his mind, I think better, and in my mind, better policies from the EU regarding GMOs and others, we'd solve this problem pretty quickly. So I think technology is the answer here. Again, the relative rates that we've changed things, though, have caused some imbalances. And, you know, it's just like the pork industry and the beef industry. They're going to get back to profitability. I mean, as a matter of fact, right now the futures market says that the pork industry may have its second or third best year ever this year. But it's been a painful process to get there.
Okay. We've got time for one question from the audience. So looks like we've got go ahead.
My name is Randall Thalman. I'm from 50 miles southwest of Twin Cities in Minnesota. Our family, I don't have any title or initials behind my name. We've been farming there for 135 years. The premise was made is that grain prices are up. My premise is they ought to be. Back in 2005, my son and I, he contacted his university economist and helped us create some charts. We did the CPI. Based at 1960 going through 2005. It was up about 7 times. We then based the price of corn at $1 at that time. And it told us in 2005 that the price of corn ought to be between $6 and $7. We marketed our grain accordingly. Then you say, well, but you've got this big yield per acre that you don't take into account. So we took the yield of Minnesota farmers got, actual yields, as USDA told us, times the actual price they received. And we charted that. And we're still short, by the way. But what it clearly says, and what, Mr., you didn't point out, is you called it, you said, I'm just taking notes that I wrote here on my chart. You said that there was losers. We created, RFS created winners and losers. What you didn't say is that the growers of the corn and soybeans have been losers for the last 30 years. And on the chart, it clearly shows. Thank you. I've got a couple extra charts if you, but it clearly shows that in 1985 we went into a 30-year sideways trend as the consumer price index went up, and we lost ground. And the livestock people kind of got ahead of us. But the thing is, you can go to any equipment dealer in the state. The farmers did not put this money in their pocket. Sales of John Deere, red, green, blue, any other, is huge. And basically what that is doing is perhaps best described as what happened in Texas. Texas had had a drought like in the 30s, except it was hotter and drier. But we didn't have dust storms because the farmers over time invest their profits into better equipment, better management ability. And if we were to get a bad drought this summer, it will not hurt us or the world as badly because we as farmers have reinvested those profits into more productivity and more dependable productivity.
Okay, I didn't hear a question there necessarily.
I didn't either. Any
response?
That's fine.
Okay. Okay, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up then. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't see any reason getting argued.
Nope.
Please welcome Bob McCormick and his panel.
It's really nice meeting you.